Hello and welcome to Lexitecture, a podcast about word origins and histories. My name is Ryan, and in each episode, my friend Amy and I bring a new pair of words to share their stories with each other and you. You can find our past episodes and the occasional blog post on our website at lexitecture.com. Follow along with us on Twitter and Facebook at Lexitecture. And if you really like what we do, you can support the show at patreon.com/lexitecture. Today's episode, Slight Hyperbole.
So, the word that I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to pause for a moment and not say what I want to say, because every single time, in the privacy of my own home and in the privacy of my own head, I would always pronounce this word hyperbole, because I am a contrary human being. It is, of course, hyperbole. And this is one of the reasons why I like this word so much. What a bonkers pronunciation.
Yeah.
Every other word that starts with hyper, it's pronounced hyper. I can't think of another example where you stress the second syllable rather than the first. But, you know, hyperbole and all its related forms gets that distinction. So, of course, as an English teacher, this is a concept that I teach to kids. And invariably, they look at it and say hyperbole. And I say, yeah, why isn't it pronounced hyperbole? Who knows, kids? It just isn't. Usually we make a bit of a joke and pronounce it hyperbole in the classroom. And I wonder if I've just taught these kids trash. That's sort of how it goes.
Yeah, that's fair.
So one of the reasons why I like this, another one of the reasons why I like this word so much is it's a rhetorical figure. And they are cool.
Yeah.
Super duper whooper cool. And the geeky part of me that loves language really, really gets excited when it comes to rhetorical figures. And I discovered a wonderful book called The Elements of Eloquence by a writer called Mark Forsyth, which I basically describe as English teacher porn. And what The Elements of Eloquence does is it takes the mystery out of writing rhetorical figures, basically.
Okay.
So it's called The Elements of Eloquence, How to Turn the Perfect English Phrase. And it's just a wonderful book. It talks in the introduction about the fact that Shakespeare is probably the best known and by some measures the best writer of English there has ever been. Now, of course, that's a controversial statement to make. But one of the reasons why Shakespeare is such a good writer is because he really, really knew how to use rhetorical figures. And Forsyth takes us through a few examples of this, where he, to my mind, very conclusively shows that this was not about genius, once again. It was about taking certain pieces of knowledge and applying them in a way that has been proven over centuries to produce effective language. And I need to mention, I don't know what your attention towards American politics has been like over the last couple of weeks. I mean, I think it sort of ranges between horrified car crash viewing to hopes that things might get better to what the hell was Lady Gaga doing? but, you know, I didn't sit and watch the entire inauguration process because I was working. But also, it's not something that I would have done. But I was fortunate enough to see, to catch up with Amanda Gorman.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Did you see Amanda Gorman?
I haven't actually watched the thing. I didn't watch any of it. And I haven't actually seen her thing. I've seen all of the various accolades that mean that I must.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely missing out for having not done that yet, but I have not actually done that yet.
Everything about it is entirely delightful. And I mean, I don't know, I can't speak for other people's emotional reactions, but I properly wept for lots of reasons, you know, because it was beautiful, because she was just a radiant beacon of light, because the poetry was incredible, because her delivery was brilliant. Just everything about it was great. It was so great. And I saw, it was maybe Instagram, some sort of social media post where she said something along the lines of, you don't have to know the Latin names for all these rhetorical devices to be able to put them in a poem. Something along those lines. Yeah. And the response to this was from an English teacher saying, well, you may not know the names of them, but they're all there. You know, yeah. I've been trying to spot these things with my students, and the poem that you read is absolutely chock full of these things. But I interrupted myself earlier. It's not surprising that I would do that since I interrupted everybody else. The reason that I want to look at hyperbole was because I was introduced by the same friend who sent me the panda pandemic meme to hyperbole and a half.
Oh.
Are you aware of Hyperbole and a Half?
No.
It is a comic, a web comic that you will almost definitely have seen.
Okay.
And you're probably not aware that that's what it's called, by a woman called Ali Brosh.
Okay.
And have you seen the little clean all the things meme?
Oh, yeah.
The little sort of simple figure with fist in the air.
Yeah.
Ah, clean all the things.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a panel from Hyperbole and a Half.
Oh, and okay.
So my friend said, I think you'd like this, and sent me, basically I Googled the book, because she produced a book, and on Amazon it had a preview of the front of the book and the back of the book, and I read the back of the book and instantly bought it, because the back of the book was hilarious.
That's awesome.
And then, in the midst of me doing that, my friend sent me a link to one of the things, I think it's a story that went into our second book, which I've already ordered because the first one is so hilarious. So the link to the story, this was, I was in bed and I was talking to my friend and I was looking at stuff on the internet and my husband was sleeping. So, you know, I'm in the dark trying not to be too bright light distracting and yeah. He was asleep. Now, I should also point that I had my mouth taped shut because that is a thing I do to go to sleep.
I forgot about that.
I was about to say, I'm not going to explain this because I'm sure I've explained it before, but
yeah,
so I had my mouth taped shut and I read this story. And despite having my mouth taped shut, I laughed so much and so loudly that I woke Ross up. It is truly, like, it's obnoxious how funny this comic is. It's just so brilliant, so wonderful. So I was delighted to find that there is another book which I've ordered. And yeah, I'm going to get as much Ali Brosh in my eyeballs as I possibly can, because it's just wonderful. But once again, some etymology. Before I do that, just have some sort of structure to my day. There is no structure to my day. Here are some of the chapter names in The Elements of Eloquence.
Okay.
He starts us off with alliteration, which is a figure which most people are pretty aware of.
Yeah.
And then in chapter two goes right on to polyptoton. We then get antithesis and merism, the blazon, synesthesia, aposiopesis, hyperbaton, anadiplosis, hypotaxis and parataxis, hendiadys, epistrophe. Jeez. Epizoixis, syllepsis, isocolon, and the list continues.
Now, jeez.
I don't know about you, but I love the geeky, greeky words. So,
yeah,
looking at this chapter list, it filled my little heart with glee. But hyperbole is in there, of course, and it's defined as a figure of speech consisting in exaggerated or extravagant statement, used to express strong feeling or produce a strong impression and not intended to be understood literally. So, a pretty straightforward definition. In terms of its etymology, it's very obviously Greek.
Yeah.
And hyperbole, the Greek word, means excess, too much of something, which fits pretty well with our rhetorical figure definition. Excess is exaggeration, just being too much of something or other. However, when you break it down a little bit, it becomes really, really interesting. Hyper, of course, a Greek prefix meaning over and above, you know, a little word element that means to excess. So we know that we're getting towards the same idea of bigness and excess and too much.
Yeah.
But the second part means to throw. A throwing, a casting, the stroke of a missile, bolt or beam. This comes from the Greek word balein, B-A-L-L-E-I-N, meaning to throw, which in turn comes from a Pi root, gwele, G-W-E-L-E. It means to throw or to reach, this is an interesting one, with the extended sense to pierce, which I thought was really interesting, because those two things are not the same at all.
No.
But you can see how they might have come to be linked. Because if you throw something sharp, then it pierces something. I suppose it very much depends on what you're throwing. So the hypothetical source of our existence for its existence is provided by, this is from Etym Online. In Sanskrit, we have apaguria, meaning swinging, and balbaliti, which means whirls or twirls. Greek balein, to throw. Also included here is the sense of to throw so as to hit, which I think is a slightly different meaning. And also in a looser sense, to put or place or lay. We get belemnon, which means dart or javelin. Belone, needle, so that sense of piercing again. Interestingly, in Armenian, there is a word kelem from the same root, which means to torture.
Oh.
And Old Church Slavonic, yay! I have Old Church Slavonic, has zali, meaning pain.
Wow.
This sense of, you know, Lithuanian has gela, meaning agony, and gelti, meaning to sting. So it's interesting. When you consider a throw as a simple, neutral act, like a juggler might perform, then, you know, a throw is just a throw. But it very much, as I said, depends on what you're throwing. If you're throwing stones, then that sense of pain and torture is pretty obvious, pretty clear how that's come about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I quite liked this. It hadn't occurred to me at all. Cognates of hyperbole. Some interesting ones here. Anabolic. Ball. As in a dancing party, not as in a round thing.
Right.
Ballad and ballet. Ballistic, which makes good sense when you consider the sense of launching a missile.
Right.
Catabolism. Also, devil. I thought you might say that. So the word devil, it's an agent noun from Greek diabalein, which literally means to throw across, but which means in Greek to slander or attack. Yeah, quite interesting. Diabalein, diabolical, diabolos, words like that. And they all can be traced back to this Pi root, meaning to throw, to reach, or to pierce. So we get devil and diabolical. We also get words like embolism, hyperbola, hyperbole, also kill, in that same sense of, piercing. Metabolism. One of my most favourite badly spelled words, palaver. I don't know if you've encountered this, but it seems to me that since the internet happened and people write down things that before they would only say, this happens a lot. And people often write palaver, as it's spelled P-A-L-A-V-E-R, as palava.
Oh, okay.
And much as I know there are no rules in language, I don't like it. Interestingly, palaver means a long talk, a conference, a tedious discussion, but it's related to the word parable. Parable meaning comparison, which also, as you can hear pretty easily, has its roots in gwele. So, yeah, it's an interesting root. It also gives a symbol. I liked this one too. And symbol, coming from syn, the prefix, meaning together, and bole, meaning a throwing or a casting. So the word symbol literally means to throw together.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to consider a word that I think we assume that we know what it means. I do like when literal etymologies don't quite match up with actual etymologies. But yeah.
That's cool.
So, and a really interesting helping of pie. I love hyperbole because I'm quite a hyperbolic human being.
Yeah.
I think, I'm pretty excessive. And the idea that I'm kind of throwing my excess about was one that, it kind of appealed to me. It's first cited by the OED from 1529. Now, this is interesting because clearly what we're looking at here is English usage. And they're referring specifically in that 1529 citation to the formula, the rhetorical figure. So we get, by a manner of speaking, which is among learned men called hyperbole, for the more vehement expressing of a matter. So, yeah, we get this. We also have senses meaning excess or extravagance. This is a pretty rare usage. But you can see it's not too difficult to see where that's come from.
Hmm.
Yeah, so it's all too much. All this throwing, all this piercing, to the devil with it.
Interesting. Now, okay, so this is probably a extremely esoteric question, but and it's also the second time, and I think as many in three episodes where Les Mis has showed up, but is that palaver word, the only place I've heard that I can think of off the top of my head is in the one song in Les Mis where Thénardier is planning the attack on that house.
Okay.
Do you remember that line? What a palaver, what an absolute treat to see a cat and its father pick a bone in the street. Is that, what is palaver actually?
Oh, this is just not a word that you're familiar with. Oh,
no.
Sorry. I was assuming that you knew what the word meant. So, as I said, it's literally defined as a long talk, a conference, or a tedious discussion. But it actually generally means something that's annoying or a fuss.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so all of the senses that are given here relate to speech, discourse, comparison, all that sort of thing. But yeah, it's like... Sorry, I'm reading and talking at the same time. Sometimes my brain explodes a little bit when I do that. Idle, profuse talk. But the sense that I know it is, what a palaver. As in, what a carry-on, what a fuss, what a problem. Something that should have been easy, but that became, what a palaver, what an absolute treat. I didn't pick that one up at all.
So, that's cool. Neat. I do like it, and you're 100% right, everyone should just pronounce it hyperbole.
Yeah, because... also hyperbole sounds like it sounds like the World Series, but for I don't know, language maybe.
Yeah,
it's the
welcome to the hyperbole.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
It's also this brings up something I was last episode when you were talking about pantalones, pantaleones, and pantaleones, all that stuff, it reminds me of my new absolute favorite intentional and fun mispronunciation of a word.
Ooh.
Is the new way to pronounce testosterone as though it were a type of Italian pasta. Testosterone.
Oh, that's absolutely wonderful. I saw one of these things on the internet this week, and it was questioning about in the phrase taking Aristotle to Chipotle, is it better fun to mispronounce Chipotle or Aristotle? And
but you have to do, they have to rhyme. It's either Aristotle to Chipotle. Or Aristotle to Chipotle.
Yeah, we favoured Aristotle. We quite like that.
Yeah. Aristotle.
It does become problematic, though, when you're a language idiot. Ross and I find this happens quite a lot because you find yourself unable to remember what the real pronunciation of the word is.
Yeah.
I know that we've spoken about this before. That, like the one that we always say is stamina, which every time I say, there is a slight thoughtful pause before I say it because my brain is going stamina, stanima, stamina, stanima, stanima, stanima. And sometimes really, really struggling to figure that out. Yeah. I must have told you this before. I don't know. This is a bit of a British anecdote that might not make any transatlantic sense. But in the UK, when you buy milk, you buy full fat milk, which usually comes in a blue container, not a bag.
Okay.
Then there's skimmed milk, which is the watery stuff that comes in the red container.
Which is water lying about being milk, yes.
And then the kind of halfway house, if you don't want all of the fat of full fat milk, but you prefer your milk not to be water, there's semi-skimmed milk, right?
Okay.
So basically, semi-skimmed is fat content-wise, it's in the middle. So people will have that because they prefer the texture of it, but also because it's less fat.
Right.
But my mum always talks about semi-skilled milk. I think partly because the L of skilled and the L of milk just merged together so beautifully. But
yeah,
so it was always referred to in our house as the semi-skilled milk.
That's awesome.
Apart from the one time where my mum went to a shop and asked someone for some semi-skilled milk and was very embarrassed about it. We thought this was hilarious, of course.
That's awesome.
So, I do feel like it should be more acceptable to just willfully mispronounce words sometimes.
Yeah. At some point, I'm going to be reading something and I will pronounce testosterone as testosterone.
Testosterone. There's a hilarious, very local example of that. Dundee has two football soccer teams and their stadia are on the same street. Yeah, that's
okay.
People that... either go or they go, are you crazy? This can't be right. But they're literally around the corner from each other.
But
so this of course brings up all sorts of interesting match day issues. And I think that the policing kind of considerations are legion. But Dundee, two teams, one street. So one of the grounds is called Dens Park. That belongs to Dundee Football Club. And the other one is called Tannadice, which is Dundee United Football Club. Incidentally, I don't have any particular allegiance myself, but my husband is a Dundee United fan. So the Theatre of Dreams, as he refers to it, is Tannadice. Now, Tannadice is spelled T-A-N-N-A-D-I-C-E and was memorably pronounced by a football commentator as Tannadici.
Well, that's fantastic.
I'm not entirely sure who it was and whether it was a deliberate Nigella Lawson-style mispronunciation. She got she came under fire recently for talking about the microwave. And of course, the media being the media, all sorts of videos and clickbait stories started to appear about, you won't believe how Nigella pronounces this common word.
Right,
she was just being silly. But yeah, Tannadici amuses me greatly. Tannadici and testosterone, they sound like they could be on the same menu.
Yeah, absolutely they would be. Very cool. Once again, our words have meshed wonderfully into a weird, unintentional symbiosis because you've got hyperbole, which is all about getting big, and my word today is slight.
Ooh.
And so slight... let's run through basically the three sort of the, well, I'll leave it up to you to say which you think is sort of the primary current usage, but there's sort of adjectivally having little weight or substance, not being very big or important, a small amount of that type of thing. And then of course you can slight someone, insult or belittle them, and you can subject someone to a slight by doing that, which is the noun form of the same thing. So I don't know what comes to your mind first.
It's interesting. You primed it a little bit by saying that it was about becoming small.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. It's a little bit like saying, if you hadn't known the answer, what would your answer have been?
Yeah.
But I think that I would probably have gone for slight... I don't know. I think I would, like, as in a slight figure or a slight...
Right.
As in slightly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit, slightly odd. It's a little bit odd. So yeah, I think I would have gone for the sense of smallness. But yeah, I don't know. The sense of being slighted is... You've confused me okay. entirely. I simply don't know.
Well, that's going to get worse before it gets better, because we're going to start right with the pi root, which is L-E-I,
okay.
and sometimes with an S at the beginning. So it's lay, or sometimes sly, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this word means slimy.
What?
Yeah. So, from pi, it goes through the Germanic languages and arrives at Old Scandinavian before showing up in Middle English around 1300. And by the time it showed up in Middle English, it means something like smooth or flat, you know, flat level, or sometimes hairless.
Okay.
And so that's what slight means originally in around the year 1300. And most of the transitional, you know, through that course of the Germanic to Scandinavian to Old Norse and all the rest, it involved emphasis on the flatness and smoothness of the thing.
Mm.
So one particular portion of the concept of slime, without the portion of slime.
It's Although very difficult to imagine slime without the
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, and there is... I find myself wondering if etymologically it has ever not had that quality.
Yeah, I don't know.
How would you measure that? You know, how would you possibly answer that question?
So the Etym Online, there was an Etym Online little tangent about the pi root that did present a theory that it meant, sort of at the same time, it meant both slippery and sticky, which sort of does define slime as well. Like,
yeah,
it's sort of both, like slippery and sticky, which is weird. Because originally I was like, those are opposites, dummy. But
they're not really.
They're not.
Not in some consistency, you know, not in some substances, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I couldn't find very many examples of the sticky side of the pi root. And the American Heritage Dictionary basically just ignores it entirely.
The sticky side of the pirate.
Yeah. the American Heritage Dictionary kind of ignores it altogether, so take that for what it's worth. But anyway, mostly on this word's journey, it just has the flat, smooth, slick type of idea to it. Mm-hmm. It does show up in Old English before it makes its full-fledged arrival in Middle English, but it only shows up as part of a compound word that means level with the ground.
Oh.
So it's a portion of that word, but it's not a standalone Old English word at all.
That's very interesting, because before you can measure things being level, you know, that if you think about that as a concept, measuring whether or not something is flat or level, there's not very mm-hmm. many natural ways to do that, but watery things, they're flat.
Yes, know? That's true, yeah.
But and then
like
I suppose,
you say, one
like,
of the only things.
It's interesting that from flatness you get to level with the ground, because of course flat is relative.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's cool.
And so in the earliest, this is also the first time that the verb form of slight shows up, but it's an obsolete use now. It was around the attestations in the OED go from about 1300 to the early 1600s, and it just means to make level or smooth.
Right.
So to slight something is to sand it down and plane it and make it level, essentially. And then around 1400, the adjective takes on the meaning of having a slender or slim build or form. Or when you're talking about a material or a texture, it's like a flimsy or weak, sort of feathery, not very substantial texture or,
That's really cool. I really want to know how that happened.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I wonder if it's the things, like, if you picture something that has a very kind of not ethereal, but a very slight texture to it, maybe that lays flatter than your leathers and wood and substantial
things. Do you know what I was thinking about? Purely because when you said level, I wasn't thinking at all about planing. But then you said to, you know, to plane something to make it level. And I started to think about wood shavings, which are slight. But this is a, this is the folkiest of folky etymology. I really want to know how making something flat translated itself into skinny, slight people. Yeah.
Yeah. So the longest lasting and most continuous, seemingly most continuous sense of the word is as an adjective. Mm-hmm. And then by sort of 1530 is the first citation that has the sort of more modern sense of small in amount.
Sorry, and something that's just occurred to me, and I don't know if you'll be able to answer this question or not, but are slim people slimy, etymologically speaking?
Well, I think so. I think it does. I think there is a connection there. I'm just looking now. I don't actually see that I specifically made that connection for some reason. Somehow I didn't. That didn't twig in my brain, but I think that it might come from the same line of things, although I don't know. I'll have to look that up. But so you get small in amount in 1530, and then the rest of the 16th century, early 16th century uses are sort of similar. So of things lacking solid or substantial qualities, of people having low worth or status, and from the examples, I don't know that it necessarily means a low worth, as in low kind of value or any sort of moral judgment, but more just like monetary, of humble origins.
Okay.
A slight person was a humble or lowly person.
Slim is
status-wise.
Slim people are not slimy, incidentally. I just had to be look.
Okay.
Thin or slight or slender comes from Dutch slim, which means bad, sly, or clever. Interestingly,
I was going to say you're off the hook, Graham, but no, not anymore.
And the Proto-Germanic sense it's given here is slembas, which means oblique or crooked. It's interesting that slimness seems to have had negative connotations, but it does have the very lovely obsolete extended adjectival form slimsy, which means flimsy or insubstantial, and slimmikin, which I like quite a lot.
Well, and of course, often people who are slightly crooked and devious and cunning are often referred to as being slimy anyway. So
yeah, that's an interesting one. Sorry, pray continue.
That's right. The other early 16th century use is can be either of people or things, and it is sort of being unimportant or trifling.
Right.
A trivial matter is a slight matter. And then by the beginning of the 1600s, we get the verb kind of comes back. And changes now to reflect this general idea. And so to slight means to render unimportant or to treat as unimportant.
Right.
To reflect that changing adjectival use. Although in the middle 17th century, so the middle of the 1600s, you're seeing it as the leveling sense, but in a very particular, like to raise or utterly destroy something. You would slight your enemy's fortresses, meaning to basically using the same way you'd talk about someone leveling someone or something, you know, like that idea.
That's cool.
So that sort of makes sense. And then for a little while in the mid 1500s to early 1600s, there was a noun form that just meant a very small amount or weight. So you could have a slight of something.
Oh, okay.
That came and went pretty quickly. And then in the 1700s, that's when you get the noun, a slight, meaning a display of disregard or belittling or those other senses of the verb the aggressive verb form, if you will.
Yeah.
And you get slight comes around as a, he suffered a slight at the hands of someone else or because of his words, was in the 1700s. And so that's kind of how those all come together. Going back to the Pi root for actual cognates, and I guess that's why my list didn't include the word slim.
Well, that would be certainly a reasonable explanation.
So cognates of slight are slime, slippery, slick, which all make good sense.
Good slimy sense, yeah.
Schlep was one, and it's one of my favorite words.
It's a great word.
And this is from Yiddish and then from Middle German, meaning to pull. And so I'm sort of assuming that in the same way that slime helps a snail drag along the ground, maybe that's where that idea comes from. The other one that jumped off the page and punched me in the face was the word oblivion.
Ooh.
And this is related to slime and sliminess. It comes from the Latin obliwisci or oblivisci, meaning to forget, in the sense that it has...
Oblivion is directly about forgetting.
In the sense that something has slipped from your mind or memory.
Oh, that's slid away. Fantastic.
And so that's the L-I without the S. Most of the other ones had the S, the slay or slay connection, but that one just has the L-I. But the L-I in oblivion is meaning to just literally just to sort of slip away.
That's so great. Slippery memories. Wow.
Yeah, so slight is just slimy, unlike slim people, but slight, like schlepping people, slimy. And like ultimately the oblivion to which we're all headed.
Oh, I do like it when we finish on oblivion.
Right?
And that's it for another episode of Lexitecture. To get in touch with us about something you heard in this episode, you can email us at words@lexitecture.com. You can also follow along and talk to us at Lexitecture on Facebook and Twitter, and at Lexitecture Podcast on Instagram. For back episodes and the occasional blog post, visit us at lexitecture.com. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.